Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Compressed FM, a podcast all about web development and design with a little bit of zest. We are live on YouTube and Twitch to talk about monorepos, which I just mentioned is something that I know very little about, honestly, and I'm excited to get to learn with our guest, Yuri from Narwhal. Hey, everyone. My name is James Q. Quick, and I am a full-time technical content creator.
Hello. My name is Amy Dutton, and I'm the director of design at Zeal.
And we have Yuri with us. Yuri, do you want to introduce yourself and tell people a little bit about you?
Hey, yeah, sure. Yeah, my name is Yuri. I'm from Northern Italy, working for Narwhal, specifically NX, for quite a while. I'm currently there the director of developer experience, so covering all the DevRel and content and so.
Very cool. And today we are joined by two amazing sponsors in Storyblock and Rapid API. Storyblock is a headless CMS that offers a unique combination of visual editing tools and highly customizable content blocks for marketers, which is really a lot of fun to work with. I'm actually doing some content with them over the next couple of months that I'm excited about. And then we also have Rapid API, which is the world's largest API hub where you can consume multiple APIs with one API key and track that in one dashboard, as well as sell APIs as well. We'll talk more about both of these throughout the show, but thank you to Storyblock and Rapid API for sponsoring. So, Yuri, do you want to kick us off with, I guess, just the basic idea of like, what is a monorepo, or like, what's the use case for a monorepo to get us started?
Cool. Yeah, so monorepo is basically, at the very, very high level, just one, usually Git repository with multiple projects. So that's kind of it. Monorepo sounds kind of weird as a term in general. Like the counterpart of it would be what people call polyrepo, which is even weirder probably. So like the difference is really just like normally or many cases you have one project per Git repo. So that's kind of the classic approach if you want. And then like if you have more than one project in one Git repository, that's what usually is being called like a monorepo. In general, like, it's very popular in the open source world. So people don't even recognize it probably, but if you look at like Vite or React or Angular, like all those like Astro, all those projects, usually if you take a look, they have that packages folder, which is mostly just a convention of naming, right? But then they have like multiple packages in there. And the main goal is just to develop them cohesively and then publish them individually to like NPM. And that basically is a monorepo per se, like based on like having multiple projects and a Git repo.
I didn't think about the NPM packages.
This is a fun fact. The Compressed FM repo is a monorepo.
Yeah,
because we have backend Sanity running. Mm-hmm. As well as the front end. It's a Next.js mm-hmm. project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the next use case, which is like we tried to actually classify them somehow to give them names, right? Just so that you can refer to them. And so, for instance, the open source variant that I mentioned before is what we usually call like package-based monorepos, simply because they are meant to have like host couple packages. And the main goal there is usually just publish to NPM. But you still want to develop them kind of cohesively because it makes sense, right? So like for Vite, for instance, I know they have like the core package and then they have adapters for like React or Vue or other pieces. And that's a very common use case, right? So you don't want to publish like one gigantic package, but you want to have like those individual modules that people then can install just based on what they need. But during development time, you want to have the comfort of just running integration tests across all of them and like have a demo app maybe hosted inside that same repo to test it out, right? And so the next use case is then, which a lot of companies actually use, is hosting front-end and back-end, for instance, just because it's so convenient, right? I mean, like a lot have like node-based back-ends, for instance. And then if you have like front-end, like JavaScript-based, you can easily like have them in one place and kind of share types and all that type of stuff. So it's very convenient from a development perspective.
That's actually really relevant to something I've been working on. Amy, I don't actually know how much you know about this, but I was working on automation for creating our promotional images for these streams and for the podcast episodes. And I was having trouble inside of serverless functions in Next.js to be able to upload an image, which I would have thought I would have been able to do. But once it actually got hosted in Vercel, I didn't have access to certain libraries that it needed. And I tried a few different things and couldn't figure it out. I was going to add a full Node.js backend as a third project into the monorepo. But I had an issue where I needed permissions to be able to pull that into somewhere to host it. And at the time, it was just easier to go and create a separate repo myself and host it. But the thing that I missed, we haven't actually fully converted the site to TypeScript, but the code that I was working on was in TypeScript. So I was creating these types and I was thinking in my head, like this would be the perfect use case of like, we could reuse these types across the Next.js project and in the Node.js project. And I didn't have any idea, honestly, how that works. So I think you kind of called it out, like sharing code in general, and then specifically TypeScript definitions is probably a pretty common use case for why you might want to keep both of them included in one project.
Yeah, totally. A lot of people also start out to just like, they have maybe a single project. And if you are in a situation where like you have a tool, like my case, we develop an X. So that is like one that we obviously use for our own clients and like consulting that we do. Like if they start out with one big app, let's say it can be an Next.js app or React app or whatever, Angular app. Usually what people do is like they classify, like they structure the application some sort of way, right? Like you have different areas, domain areas, whatever. And so you usually do that just with folders. And so a common scenario that we see is like people, it gets really messy. Like over time, like it gets huge and huge, right? You have multiple teams maybe working on it. And so for instance, with NX, we usually propose people like try to split them up, right? Like you are in, you have a tool with NX, for instance, that handles or helps you handle monorepos. And so splitting that up is very easy, even though technically it's still just that one app, but you split it up into like the app, which is very thin. And then you have like libraries that are just reusable within that workspace. So that's kind of like a recommendation that we often like push people toward. And the interesting thing there is like they don't even think about it as a monorepo. It's just, well, a good way to modularize your application, right? But once you have that modular structure, like referring to the reusability that you mentioned, right? You see, oh, actually, I could actually have two apps, right? Deploy them separately, scale them separately. Because now it's easy. Like the app itself doesn't really have a whole lot of logic. It's more like bundling the libraries that I split out, right? And so at that point, people start thinking, oh, that's actually nice. Now can I have a second app, maybe even have like a different type of app, like for the public facing, I use Next.js, or for like an admin dashboard, I use just a classic React app for whatever reason, right? So those type of strategies can be then very, very convenient in such an environment.
We had a project at Zeal where we had two separate repos, and it made sense because we had the front end and the back end, and they were two completely different teams. And so it seemed like when you're trying to manage pull requests and things like that, let's keep everything separate. But one of the things that we found was that when you're talking about a feature set, usually you'll create all the work on the back end that will provide those services for the front end. And so then you have these repositories that are kind of in tandem, but not really. And so we ended up creating a giant mono repo because that way our commits would be able to bundle the backend services with a front end feature together in a single PR.
Yeah, that's actually a very, very good example as well. Mm-hmm. And to me, that speaks usually towards like the trying to facilitate communication over, like communication mm-hmm. in general, right? Because you have a lot of overhead if you have like different repos. And so like one thing that people then often like complain about is like, yeah, but then if we throw everything together, right, then we have to kind of coordinate with others. And just like, yeah, that's the whole point, right? Like you should collaborate. So very often, like it kind of uncovers some issues that have been already there. But like, yeah, as long as everyone kind of works in their own kind of isolated areas, you just see it at the integration point that it kind of may be a bit rough, right? But you don't confront people that directly as if they work in the same repo, right, at some point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that whole code sharing in general and communication, facilitating communication is a very, very big point of like why you would want to use monorepos.
Yeah. Well, it makes a big difference too when you're trying to go back through the project's history, because those things are all grouped together in a single feature versus like trying to compare and contrast two different repos and trying to get all everything to line up.
Yeah. You basically avoid all that communication overhead about like which version on the backend side should go with which, like, when can we release, when can you release. You basically ideally have it in one commit, right?
Yeah.
Which is another very interesting point, is like you can just have a branch even for testing out stuff across like front and backend, right? You want to try out an idea, it's very easy. You just create a branch, implement some part of the backend side, or some colleague basically jumps in and does that, and you integrate it on the front end side. You run an experiment, maybe even deploy it to some like testing environment or something. And well, if it's not working, just discard that branch, right? But otherwise, you would have to kind of coordinate, right? Like maybe even you have like external libraries or something, because like let's say design systems common use case. Oh, can you just like publish that beta version so I can import it in my kind of repo? And then which version was it? And so like there's a lot of that type of overhead, right?
Yeah, it's a huge thing when you're talking about versioning, because you don't want one library running in a certain version on the back end and then another library, or really the same library running a different version on the front end. You want to keep all that in sync. And so mono repo, when you're pulling from the same package grouping, makes it easier. How are you running and like managing all that? Because I've used Yarn. Yarn has a feature where you can do workspaces and set up different workspaces for each feature. Is that what you're doing, or are you reaching for something else?
Yeah, NX basically is the tool that can help you develop those monorepos. Now, you can basically start with like a Yarn NPM, PNPM workspace, which actually a lot do, and they start with that. And the problem that you usually face at that point is like when the monorepo gets bigger, you might run into some issues like in terms of CI time, right? That is usually the pain point that people kind of mention, right? There's like, hey, I have this Yarn workspace or NPM workspace set up, works fine, but now we have like 100 projects in there, which usually you find in enterprise environments. Like our CI time is like 1.5 hours or something, which is obviously like
CI then it discards like overall build time.
Yeah, it's like the build time, test time, linting. Like there's a lot of processes that potentially run there, right? And so that is kind of then counterproductive because like at one hand, like you want to have that monorepo for improving the coordination, like communication and improving speed overall, right? But then if CI takes like over an hour, it's kind of discards the whole point of it. And so that's when then you then kind of have NX that we develop as a tool, which you can place on top of like a Yarn workspace, for instance. And what it does there is mostly like address those pain points in terms of handling the task scheduling, like running the builds, running the tests and linting much more efficiently. Because for instance, in Yarn workspace, usually what happens is you just run like the builds and then the lints and then the tests and whatever, right? While with NX, for instance, you can just like say, well, like in that specific PR, run all the projects that got touched or are somehow affected by that change, right? So it reduces the scope of it because knowing, well, that package and that package depend on each other, right? So if you change this one, well, you should test also the other one, right? Because they depend on each other. So things like that, there's basically kind of a project graph being constructed behind the scenes. And so you can do like those type of optimizations, right? Just run those two projects while the others didn't get touched. So there's no point of like running them again, right? So that is one point. And then the other one is being like caching. So the same thing, right? Like if you run the test, but you, then in the next subsequent PR, you did never touch any test or spec file, well, you can just pull it out of a cache. So you don't even run the whole computation at all. So that's basically the added benefit of why at some point you might need some sort of tool.
Where does that cache live? Because I'm thinking about like in your CI stuff, like when you run a build, it's out there on a server somewhere that's ephemeral, which means you probably it probably spins up like a VM, it runs your build and it goes away. So where does that cache actually live? Is that in the host of where your builds are happening or in the code?
Yeah, it's a good question. So normally, like by default, it lives like locally. Like whenever you build locally and you run tests, like even on your own machine, because in the node modules folder is a .nx.cache folder and that's where it lives. Now, obviously, if you kind of do it on CI, well, you could go and say, well, store me that cache in that folder. And then like CI like environments have the possibility to cache those folders in between like different PRs and stuff. So to restore it, similar to what you do usually with the node modules folder. But we do like when you want to remotely distribute it, we have actually a dedicated service for that. So there's like NX Cloud where you can then point to it and you would just store the cache to like an external party and restore it from there. The main reason there being that it doesn't just do the caching, but it also has other features like the distribution of the tasks and stuff. So like running tasks across machines, across different machines, and not just on one machine in parallel, right? Just to further optimize those type of things. But yeah, we use a dedicated service for that.
So my question for people that are not familiar is how would you set up a workspace within Yarn or PNPM? PNPM, yeah.
You mean how you set them up from the ground, like from when you start through?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so basically at some point, we can actually go a bit back because like years ago, like there was one tool that's called Lerna. And that was the first one that actually brought up the whole monorepo space. And as a side note, we from NX, our core team kind of took over the stewardship of Lerna like half a year ago because it was kind of declared unmaintained like that basically. And so we were like, hey, it's kind of the same thing as we do. So why not push it forward? And so Lerna was one of the first that kind of set up those monorepos by introducing a mechanism that allows local linking of packages, right? So if you build a package, you don't have to reach out for the public NPM registry, but you can actually just locally link them. And the main reason was that at that point, like package managers like NPM and Yarn and PNPM, which even came in much later, didn't have any of those type of features. And so now, as you correctly mentioned, like now there's what you call like workspaces. So there's like NPM workspaces and Yarn workspace and PNPM workspaces. And usually what you have to do there is mostly just declare there's a workspace property, like a package JSON, for instance, where you say like workspaces colon and there's an array where you say like the packages folder is where my local packages live. So that's where my monorepo should live. You can even specify multiple ones. So for instance, if you have, which is actually pretty common, you have the packages and then you maybe have an apps folder or demos or whatever, which like want to also locally consume those packages. Well, you would have like two folders in there. And so that's usually how you declare it. I think PMPM has actually a YAML file instead of just like declaring it in package.json. But like the syntax is exactly the same. So it's pretty straightforward. Actually, if you go on dev.to/nx, there is like, if you scroll a bit down, there's actually an article where I used a PMPM workspace, set that up from the ground up, like step by step, what you need to do to the point to what we discussed before, like when you would add an X on top just for the purpose of speeding up things and caching and all that type of stuff. But yeah, that's how you set up like something with workspaces.
There's a question in the chat that is, what would be the best way to link repos if every repo, if they're interlinked with each other?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a tricky one because like there is Git submodules, but I never want to really recommend those because like we have used them in the past. We, like, the main reason is usually we have those different repos. We have maybe external contractors working with us. So we don't want to necessarily have them see those single repos, like some part of the monorepo, right? Which I usually at that point recommend against even trying to combine them. Maybe create two separate ones. You don't need to have like one single one. So if there's for some reason like read access restrictions for whatever reason, right? So probably not a good point to actually combine them. But the only way that would come to my mind is actually using Git submodules. But my experience have been more messy than helpful. They can create actually a lot of like confusion. Like even Git, we all know, it can be kind of tricky sometimes, but Git submodules kind of much more tricky.
Yeah, I use Git submodules. Oh, don't judge me. When I was doing WordPress development, and I had like a plugin that I would reference. It was a premium plugin, so I would put that in a private repo so that nobody else could see it, and then I would pull it in dynamically, and I would use Git submodules because it wasn't my code. It was somebody else's code, and I didn't want to manage that inside of my repo. And the confusing thing is when you try and hand that off to another developer, if they're not familiar with submodules, you click on that folder and it looks empty because you have to run a command to be able to like basically pull down all the code that would go inside that Git submodule folder as well.
Yeah, but that's the perfect use case that I mentioned before, right? If you have like some reason like you cannot give read access to people, but like if you're like just a small team, it might even work because you can come up like with some automation or something, right? But I've seen it being used like with like 300 developers on a monorepo, which, it's kind of a mess at some point.
It's really interesting. I was kind of thinking back earlier of my experience when I was at FedEx, where we had, this is a slightly different architecture conversation, I think, but some similarities of, we went from a monolithic Java application to looking into and creating microservices. So it was like completely separate projects, deployed completely separately, versioned completely separately. And that was, and I think still is, like a big push for modernization. And there's a lot of benefits that do come with that. But one of the like very obvious complications was like, if you're onboarding a new developer and just to start the application, you've got to download 10 different projects. You've got to start them each up. You've got to know how they interact with each other. Going back to versioning, you've got to know like what version the different ones are on. And if you need to make an update here based on updated data coming from somewhere else, those need to be in sync. And that was, again, still lots of benefits, but those were like really big struggles that we face. So it's kind of interesting to hear about this in a more, I guess, just a slightly different perspective, like more in the web development ecosystem specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, but the whole micro front end and the microservices architecture, like, is a good point because like a lot of time people even say like, well, you either have a monorepo or you have like microservice, which actually they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, exactly.
You can totally have like microservice host and monorepo.
Yep.
Now, what I usually say is like, if you have microservices, they should ideally, like you should have them because you have like teams distributed across the globe, right? You have like some in Europe that work on their own microservice and some like in US, whatever, right? So it's being structured around your team structure. Then it makes a lot of sense, right? That is one use case. Another use case is when people talk about independent deployment. And that's when we usually say like, well, wait a minute, because if you just need the independent deployment part of it, you can totally use a monorepo, have like different apps in there, leverage the code sharing and then of like local libraries in the monorepo, but still independently deploy those apps, right? With your own rhythm and whatever. But you don't have to worry at that point about like, version mismatches and all mm-hmm. that type of coordination, which you might not want to, right?
Yep.
But it still kind of keeps open the gate. Like if at some point you're like, hey, but now we want to go full microservice for whatever reason, right? It still can go, right? You still can go at a point because you have it modularized already. So you have mm-hmm. the boundaries already kind of defined, and then it's, the step is just like one step more risk that you have to make.
I think that actually would have been a perfect solution for us, because to your point of like building, adopting that architecture based on team is not what we did. We had a team of 5 or 6 developers and that was it. And we were trying to do all these different microservices. Having something like what you just said, I think would have made a lot more sense.
In terms of deployment, I know if you're using something like Vercel, when you point it to the repo, it'll also ask you which folder you mm-hmm. want to deploy. So we have the advent of CSS and the advent of JavaScript in a monorepo originally because they were going to pull from the same FAQs, but that didn't end up happening. Either way, we have 2 projects in Vercel. One is for advent of CSS, and it's deploying that particular code base. And then we had advent of JavaScript, and it's deploying that particular code base, but it's both referencing the same repo. So there's tools within the deployment systems that you have to be able to handle that. The other thing I wanted to ask about was somebody had a question about NPM link and how all that works. The only experience I've had with NPM link is when you're trying to create your own NPM packages and you want to test those out, mm-hmm. you can create a link so that you can do that locally. Is there anything that you could maybe add specifically for link?
No, that's just usually a use case you have. Like you have an external package that you develop in its own repo, right? And then you have basically your project and you want to test it out before actually pushing it up like to NPM. And then you kind of can use something like NPM link. I think Yarn has a similar mechanism and can install it locally. In a monorepo scenario, if you have the package co-located, you don't really need it because you would have like an NPM workspace mm-hmm. setup, which mm-hmm. does it for you basically transparently. So yeah, but it's definitely useful if you have external packages, which even in a monorepo scenario, like a lot of people believe like, well, now I use a monorepo in my company, so everything needs to be in there, right? Which is actually not what you usually want. Like for Google, that's the case, right? Like I think they have like a 90% or something in one gigantic monorepo, right? I think also Twitter and Meta. But they have actually even like custom tooling around to make sure it would, they have their own Git implementation to make it work, right? Yeah. So it's at that scale, like which that's not you usually, right? Yeah, even in our case, we have like some really huge customers, which like as mentioned before, like 300-400 developers working on one monorepo. But even then, like it's usually scoped around business units. Maybe they have like multiple monorepos in the whole entire organization. And they share code in, even between across monorepos, mm-hmm. right? So potentially like you develop the design system in one monorepo because it makes sense to have there for some reason, right? You can still package it up and publish to like a local registry and then pull it in into your non-monorepo projects or other monorepos as well, right? So that is still valid. It's not that you completely ignore it. Yeah.
And now let's take a second to talk about Rapid API, the world's largest API hub. Rapid API is used by over 3 million developers to find, test, and connect to thousands of APIs, all with one single API key and dashboard. Find the APIs that you need for your project, embed that API into your app, and track the usage of all your APIs in that single dashboard. If you create an API, you can use Rapid API to make it available to over 3 million developers already using the hub. Now, you can also configure this to sell your API so you can make money off of your API. And lastly, I want to mention the Visual Studio Code extension, the Rapid API client extension, that you can use to test your APIs and connect to your dashboard as well. Similar to something like Postman, where you can test your CRUD endpoints, you can do all that with an extension right inside of VS Code and have this be connected to a project in Rapid API Studio. So make sure to check out Rapid API at rapidapi.com, and thank you to Rapid API for sponsoring.
When you're looking at teams that have crazy mono repos like that, how do they manage all the PRs and things that come in? Because I'd imagine you'd have a PR that you have no idea what it is. Are there multiple people that are checking those? How does that work?
Yeah, usually you use mechanisms, the code owner files and that type of thing. So in general, like that's a good question because like for me, that is also one of the key points is like there's speed of monorepos, mm-hmm. but there's also maintainability aspect, right? And so for NX, for instance, we have those package-based monorepos like with Yarn and NPM workspaces, but then we also have like what we call integrated monorepos, which is monorepos that have like a plugin-based system. So we have plugins that handle some of the aspects for you. Like you don't have to have a Yarn workspace or NPM workspace, but we handle the linking over like TypeScript, for instance. And the reason why I bring that up is because like that implementation has, in addition to like things like code owner files, also other measures like features that allow you to kind of make sure you think remains maintainable, like not just in the beginning, but like in even like a year in, you're just like, yeah, we're still productive. And the main reason is because you need to, at some point, not just handle the Git flows, right, with like reviews and stuff, but also make sure people don't just crazy cross-reference and have dependencies across all their packages wildly, right? Because there might be some projects which just a subset of other projects can depend on, right? Like a design system, most or all of them can probably use, right? But then there might be a very specific library for a specific feature that has a utility that does date formatting, but you don't want to like that other library for another feature depends on that, right? So you want to limit what can depend on what. And so for those type of things, you need to have some more mechanisms. Like for in NX, we use like a tagging system and linting rules, which work pretty well. So you can actually give arbitrary tags to projects and say, this is feature shop, right? And this is feature backend or admin. And then mm-hmm. you can define lint rules where you say like feature shop can just depend on other projects that have also that tag on it and not on like other stuff, right? So you would get linting errors if someone for some reason accidentally imports stuff that they shouldn't. So there is more definitely to it, but usually at a large scale. When you have those 300 developers working on it, you need to have some automation.
I will point out Mark's comment on that, but he was saying that they use code owners at the app library level. So that the team that owns that entity is the only one that can review and approve those PRs.
Yeah.
Is that a formal thing? Like, is that an actual like feature in GitHub or something?
Yeah, GitHub supports it. Also GitLab, like the most common things out there, like version control systems and platforms have it. And it's mostly useful because, like in general, like if you work in a monorepo, even if you have 300 people working on there, right, they're usually organized around those libraries and areas, right? So they would most probably just commit into their own area, right? And so the whole code owner files is just useful for if I push up a PR, well, those people are the ones that need to put their okay on the PR, right? Approve it. And so that's the main reason, right? So they would get pinged automatically. They would automatically show up as like the reviewer in the reviewer list. And so it's like an additional guard that kind of someone looks at that kind of knows what that feature area is about, right? Because they might not know about it. Like in a, such a big monorepo, but you don't know all the different areas. But it can totally happen that you just commit into another one, right? That you fix like a bug or somewhere, which kind of refactors a function that lives in another area, which you don't really belong to. And so even then, you submit the PR, that person shows up in the code owner files, would automatically be pulled in. So you need to have now two people from those two areas, right, that need to add their approval. So that works pretty well.
Yeah. One follow-up question. So I know you can define people who maybe there's five people total that can approve a PR as a whole. But are you saying with code owners, you can define these are the people that need to be notified and make approvals for code in certain directories? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Files, you can exactly.
Oh, cool.
You can limit it to directories.
And you're saying file. So is it like a config file that you add to your repo or?
Yeah, it's literally a dot code owner file or something like that. So something similar like that. And there's kind of like a very simple structure where you define like a group. Like you can even, like I know with GitLab, you can even connect that to like roles within your organization. You can set up like whole roles, which says like department for the public shop page or products list page or whatever is an entire team, right? And so those are the people that are associated to that would automatically be the approvers for that.
I'm going to go back another step because this has always been, I feel like a silly question at this point, this far in the episode, but what is the difference between, or what is the relationship between Narwhal as a company and NX as a product? And I assume like NX is just a product of Narwhal. And then if that's the case, and you can help define that, what else does Narwhal do as a whole?
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, the whole Narwhal brand, we currently reduce it and focus just on NX. And the main reason is up to now, it's basically the company. NX was our open source project, and we did consulting for Fortune 500 companies, right? And so our founders came from Google. They had big expertise in like the whole monorepo scenario in general. And so that's kind of why NX kind of was built, because they saw, well, there's like the need outside of Google, but like you don't want to have super complex tooling, but you want to have approachable tooling. And so they started like the open source project. And so most of us basically did consulting, and as our 20% project, we did develop on the NX basically and push that forward. But like NX got so much traction, especially like this year, like we just crossed 3 million downloads per week on NPM. So it's kind of blew up basically. Yeah, per week. Yeah, wow. Yeah. We started like in January with 1 million. And June, like we hit 2 million. Now just like 3 weeks ago or so, we had 3 million. So it like went like crazy.
Wow.
And that's just like NPM downloads. We know a lot of companies that, like huge companies that use it in their production systems. And so at that point, we were like, we should fully focus on it, right? We should just, like, we didn't have enough time, even though we were able to still push out a lot of features. But obviously, imagine like most of us just working 20%, like basically one day a week on it, kind of reduced our scope of what we could do. And we had a lot of ideas. And so in mid-October, we raised actually funding. So we raised like 8.6 million funding. And so now we kind of invert the situation. So we do 20% of consulting because we still want to kind of keep the connection to companies, right? See what are the pain points. That has been super beneficial for us to see, okay, this is a problem. Go back and fix it like with an X. Because usually we used an X for the consulting for those projects, right? And how to set up monorepos for them. So yeah, right now the situation is kind of inverted. So 20% kind of consulting, some of us, and the rest can now fully focus on just the open source project, which is great because now we have like much more margin of pushing out new features. NX is the main product, but then there's like NX Cloud for the whole distribution of the cache and then running on like tasks across machines on CI. So those are basically the two kind of projects that we work on.
Cool. Very interesting. There was a question or kind of a comment from someone, I think, appreciating you and your knowledge that they used to follow you for Angular stuff. Now their favorite framework is Svelte, which Amy and I are big fans of as well. Just kind of curious from a developer perspective, like what kind of things are top of mind for you now? Do you still do a lot in the Angular community? Do you do more with React and other frameworks? Like where do you spend a lot of your time in that sense?
The cool part is now I'm kind of cross frameworks, right? So yeah, I started in the Angular world. That was kind of my introduction to front-end world. I'm probably now kind of revealing my age, but I started like when front-end became kind of popular, like with jQuery kind of ish frameworks, right? And so then I found Angular, kind of accidentally went into that area, became an Angular GD and did a lot of like public speaking for Angular. And we also at Nahual did a lot of Angular specific consulting because like our founders basically came from Google, from the Angular team in particular. And so they had like that knowledge there. And so a lot of our initial consulting was Angular based. But now I feel personally lucky because I can be across frameworks, right? Because NX can be used with most of them. So I'm trying out different combinations. I do a lot of content production around like videos and stuff and blog posts to create new examples, knowledge, and that part around monorepos combination with frameworks, right? So it's kind of back and forth. The main ones are for sure for us like Angular and React, like those two are the prevalent ones. I'm curious, so I always like diving into some new stuff.
I posted on Twitter the other day to ask people how quickly the web development ecosystem moves and how new tools come out, how they come out so frequently, whether that excites them or overwhelms them. And most of the people were like, definitely both. Like they get excited to have a lot of tools, but then it's also just overwhelming. And it's kind of stressful for me, especially as a content creator. I keep telling myself like I need to focus and not take on additional things. And then I hear about a new technology or something that I hadn't seen before. And I'm like, ooh, I really want to do a video on this. And it's like impossible to keep up with.
The positive aspect of it, and again, like if you have been around long enough, there was once like the so-called JavaScript fatigue, right? But the problem was at that point, it was much worse for me personally because like the different frameworks were so different, right? Even from the like their mental models and like how the underlying concepts were so different that even going between those was kind of hard because some did use more component approach initially, like when that kind of kicked off, others still kind of MVC kind of style. So it was really completely different. Nowadays, if you look at like Angular or and then you kind of React, it's, a lot of the stuff is like, obviously there's some difference like in core models, but the stuff is around component-oriented architectures. It's a lot of syntactic stuff, just the differences, right? And then similarly, if you look now and like more modern, like Astro and Quick and those, they still have the same concepts. Well, the runtime might be different now because they have hydration, whatever, right? But at least you can bring on some knowledge which you have from another framework, which before was kind of impossible, right? Like take jQuery and then go look into Angular. Like, it's a totally different world, right? So,
yeah, that's a great point. In terms of things adopting ideas from other frameworks and kind of merging and melding.
Yeah. And also the tooling, I think, improved a lot. In fact, like I'm coming from the backend world, basically. So a lot of the things that have been there like 10 years ago, I kind of now see them coming in the front end space as well. Yep. But now it's much better integrated. Like look for things like Remix, to take an example, right? Like having those that kind of comfort of having the backend side and the front side kind of together. And so there's a lot of that aspect that improved, I think, in recent years. So I'm positive, like, in terms of how it evolved, looking back.
Yeah. want to call out another positive comment from Ken Jones Pizza, one of our favorites. He said, this has been really cool. Monorepo seemed really scary until he learned a little bit more about them. I would say I'm in the same boat. I've always been like a little bit intimidated by just conversations around monorepos because I didn't have much of an idea of what they were. And then a question that says, we're using Lerna for building an NPM library, which does not contain any UI. Each package repo is different to another, and one repo is going to be published. So how can we see the changes in the local UI? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think if I got it properly, like if you have different packages and the main purpose there is you want to push it to NPM, right? But what often happens is like you also want to see the effect of it locally before you publish. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing wrong in actually, and a lot of have that, like to have a local examples folder or demos mm-hmm. or whatever, right? Where you create a Remix app, a React app, whatever like your framework is that you're developing, right? That makes sense for you, which has an UI, but links the local monorepo packages rather than actually grabbing the NPM packages. And so again, like that is a common use case because what you can do then is, well, while you develop it, you can actually see it in action, try it out, try a couple of variations. And a lot of people also just have local end-to-end tests and running against those demos. Because you can spin up like Cypress or Playwright and just load that application, which consumes a local package in that PR that you actually are about to publish and see whether it works, right? So that is a totally legit case. So I hope I understood the question properly, but that's actually pretty common to just have a UI app in there, even if you mm-hmm. don't publish it anywhere.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, even from a documentation standpoint of view, right? Because mm-hmm. people can go in, clone repo and run it and see how it works. So
let's take a second to talk about our sponsor, Storyblock. Storyblock is the first Hella CMS that offers a unique combination of visual editing tools and highly customizable content blocks for marketers on top of a modern headless architecture that gives us, the developers, the flexibility to build fast and reliable digital platforms and marketers and content marketers to create the content that they need in a timely manner. Now, I'm actually really excited about Storyblock because I'll be doing some content with them over the next couple of months with SvelteKit and Astro on my YouTube channel. So if you want to learn more and see some hands-on stuff, go and check out the videos that I'll be doing on my YouTube channel at James Q Quick. And in the meantime, thank you a ton to Storyblock for sponsoring and make sure to check them out at storyblock.com. I'm kind of curious. So your title is Director of Developer Experience. Mm-hmm. Do you want to do like a few minutes on your career? Because I think it's really interesting. You see so many people that are developers, engineers, developer advocates, and it's always really interesting to me to get people's take on moving into slightly different roles of management and director, et cetera. So just kind of curious, like any thoughts on that transition? Was that something you were looking for? Is the balance of doing more people management versus like hands-on stuff, is it what you were looking for?
Yeah, it definitely was something that appealed to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone into that direction, basically. But it wasn't not something that I planned on purpose. And because I started basically, as I mentioned, in the backend world and kind of came in the front end, started like as a software architect, mostly on the backend side and front end architect, you want to have that kind of role or whatever. And did a lot of consulting, actually helping teams develop and produce code and doing code reviews. And it just happened that at that time at the company in Owl, we had the need to just have some more people, basically that were more senior, also look at like the growing team, right? So manage a couple of people there, manage some folks. And so that was one side where I already went into management, if you want, to have one-on-ones with my people from Europe, make sure they are all well, they kind of enjoy the work and part. So it's kind of that people management part, which I like because somehow it's, you have the purely technical part, but I also like to chat to people and see like mm-hmm. what they do and kind of interact with more folks. So that was kind of like a part-time role aside from my mostly technical focus. And then basically we just had the necessity to have someone that goes full-time into just content production. And I've been doing content production for like, for sure, 5 years. So like workshops in companies, that's where it started, and public speaking, started going into ACAD video course production, like that type of stuff, and using blog posts. And so I kind of like that aspect, and especially the combination. So you see something, you learn something about, try to digest it, and then share with others, which is kind of something which I really enjoy. And so that kind of role came up and like, hey, we need someone. I did already produce some content for Now and for NX, but as my technical 20% role, mm-hmm. just like some, oh, I have that blog post idea, let me just create one. So instead of coding on NX, I just that they produce a blog post or a video on our YouTube channel. So yeah, that's how it evolved kind of in that role. And I really enjoy it.
That's awesome. It's something I've thought a lot about in my career. And I'm in a different position now of like going out on my own with content full time. But if I were to go back to a company, that is one of the things that I would be really interested in, is leading more like kind of creating and building out and leading a DevRel team. I think that would be a really fun challenge for me. And I actually enjoy the people aspect of that as well, but I'm not 100% ready to give up all the day-to-day stuff. So I think like starting a DevRel team would be a unique opportunity to continue to do some of the execution while also building out stuff, doing the people management and kind of slowly shifting the percentages to be more of the management, the traditional management activities.
Yeah, I also pretty much like the whole DX part of it, because it's kind of talking to people, see what they like, what they don't like, as you produce content, get feedback on that, right? Or as you are at a conference and talk to someone. And I'm bringing that back to the team inside, kind of trying to steer where it goes and acts, like what are the features that we need? Does the DX feel good? Like those type of interactions, I really enjoy those, because you're still there with the technical part. So freaking look into the actual code, maybe provide like fixes and stuff. But then you have that other aspect where you try to combine. So the only downside, that I should mention that as well, is like context switching. That's kind of crazy. Yeah. Having proper focus time before was kind of hard. Now it's kind of, it's almost impossible. Like you really have to be super like focused on like blocking out time. And that's just my time for the content production. I don't even like look at Slack and anything or Twitter, because that is part of your job at that point, right? Like you should actually at some point look at it, chime into chat discussions and that type of stuff. So
I've paid a lot more attention recently to how easily distracted I am, and it's something that I want to improve on, because I'll like anytime I have something that builds for 2 seconds, like if it's longer than a handful of milliseconds, I open up Twitter or Discord, or if I'm like exporting a video and it takes like 2 minutes, I go straight to another app. It's like, I don't know, I'm working on it, but I started working on the Learn, Build, Teach Discord bot and website some yesterday. And I like opened up a branch to do one thing, and I found myself like already working on this other feature that like should have been a different branch, that I was going out and looking at other resources. And yeah, I get more distracted more easily than I think I ever realized I did before, but now it's starting to become a lot more obvious. Cool. Do you want to move into picks and plugs? So pick is something that you've used recently or watched or seen or listened to, et cetera. And then a plug is something that you want to promote, something you built, something someone else built, a community, et cetera. I think Amy's got a hard stop in a couple of minutes. So Amy, do you want to go first?
Yeah, let's do it. So my pick is going to be a book, and I bought the hardcover. I can't say the last time I bought the hardcover, but this is, it's nice that a good transition, because you guys were talking about management. This is Sarah Drasner's book, Engineering Management for the Rest of Us, and it is very good. So I'm not very far into it, but everything that I've read so far is just gold.
I've been waiting for this one.
Yeah, I have too. But she just does a great job of making things practical and talking about different aspects of management. And I think even if you're not managing people, if you aspire to it, it's a great read. And also just working with people, because it does talk a lot about like, what are the things that you value versus what somebody else values? And a lot of the times conflict comes because you're approaching maybe the same problem from a different value. And then for my plug, I'm going to plug Advent of CSS and Advent of JavaScript. We kind of referenced it earlier in the show, but this is a project that James and I created last year, and the code is still current, still is great, I think, but it's 24 challenges in the month of December. So you can go to Advent of CSS and Advent of JavaScript, either and or both, and register. So all of the challenges are free. The solutions are paid. And I believe, let's see, there is a code. Mary code. Oops, I'll stick a link in the chat and you can get 30% off.
Now we're being brave enough to go into those Advent of code stuff, just time-wise. Maybe I should try.
Yeah, it's, I mean, even if you don't get through all of it in the month of December, it's all like the challenges themselves are not like December specific. So they're great level up opportunities. Yeah. So the way this one's set up is the CSS sets up the front end for the JavaScript piece, or you could just jump into JavaScript and you have all of the CSS and design stuff already included. And that way you could just focus on the JavaScript piece of it.
Cool. Yuri, are you ready? Do you want me to go next?
No, I'm fine. Like for the picks, just because I saw it before, there's the OpenAI. I think they have now a bot, a GPT bot, basically, where you can ask questions. And I just like saw a Twitter thread just before joining the show here, which like, because I use like the GitHub Autopilot a lot. It actually helped a lot, even like writing documentation, surprisingly, and pretty good, like using your terminology, which is like super fun to look even at. And now I saw that bot that they open up. They're obviously like, I don't think you can access the page because there's so many people trying it out. But like the answers you get are like huge. Like even talk about like, give me some downsides of using a certain feature of TypeScript, and you get like a proper, like kind of a blog post of like with code examples and everything. So it's kind of mind-blowing the direction we're heading. So very excited about that one. For the plug, definitely nx.dev. That's our main website. It's our docs. Also check out, if you like videos, we have youtube.com/@nxdevtools, everything together. Try my best to create good content there. So chime in if you like video. And we have a release upcoming. So probably tomorrow, 15.3 is going to be dropped, or on Monday. And there's some super exciting features in there. So yeah, have a look.
That's awesome. Someone actually commented using some part of the Open API bot or something based on a code snippet that I shared on Twitter. And it's like different story, but I saw that pop up today. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I am going to pick an espresso maker. So Yuri and I were talking about this beforehand. My wife just bought me an espresso maker, and she's mad at me now because I have had my eye twitch for like a long time, honestly. And I've been reading like what can contribute to that, and one of those is caffeine. So I'm taking a couple of weeks off of caffeine just to see if that helps. So she's like, we just bought this espresso maker and now you're not drinking coffee, but it's only for a couple of weeks just to kind of see. But it's actually kind of a fancy. You can get decaf. True. Yeah, I could do that. But she got a pretty fancy one. It's got like a grinder in it, and it's kind of cool because you take the like thing that holds the espresso and you put it in, and it gives you the exact amount of ground espresso. So it grinds it, puts it in there, you tamp it down, then put it in, make espresso. It has a steamer or frother for milk, so you can make lattes and cappuccinos and stuff. Anyway, it's been fun to play around with. So it's a DeLonghi is the brand, which I assume is an Italian brand based on the spelling.
It's one of the most famous ones.
Cool. And then I will plug the Learn, Build, Teach community Discord. So at learnbuildteach.com, you can find that. And I've been working on the website and the Discord bot a little bit to try to kind of improve that. So I'm excited for hopefully updates and more engagement and stuff coming in the next year with Learn, Build, Teach, but you can find that at learnbuildteach.com. All right, that is going to wrap it up for this episode. Yuri, thanks so much for being here and telling us about monorepos and Narwhal and X. And in the meantime, that's all we got.